Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Life in the great Southwest. The desert gave us a little reminder this past week that it's still summertime here. Summer in Las Vegas isn't just June and July. We had a week of excessive heat warnings and power outages, and firefighters all over the West stretched to the breaking point because everything seems to be burning. You look out the window in the morning here in the Las Vegas Valley, and it looks foggy. It's smoke drifting here from other western states. I saw where federal agencies are just about to exhaust their budgets for fighting wildfires, although there's still a long way to go before a new fiscal year begins. I wouldn't want to be out there on days like this one, on the front lines of a treacherous wildfire that could change directions at any minute. But with the drought stretching on and on, year after year, we can probably expect to see more of this. In between reading books to prepare for tonight's show and doing some studying for the all-important fantasy football drafts, I've been hiding this weekend in the pool. It's not really swimming, it's more like wallowing. I'd say it's not entirely unlike what a hippo does, you know, kind of sitting there on the water, cooling off, head just barely above the waterline, maybe lurking like an octopi a little below the surface at times. However you describe it, it's not swimming. And if you live here in the West, I'm sure you can relate. But the reading I've been doing for tonight has been worth it. We've got some cool stuff to learn and to cover over the next 4 hours. This month and this week mark some notable anniversaries. For example, 60 years ago, August 21st, 1955, one of the weirdest and maybe most important alien encounters of all time occurred in a rural town of Kelly, Kentucky, just down the road from a slightly larger burg called Hopkinsville. The Kelly-Hopkinsville case is pretty famous, or at least it was long ago. Family of people had a frightening encounter with the unknown, and I do mean unknown. These were creatures described as 3 to 4 feet tall, very large eyes, really large ears, greenish skin. I know what you're thinking, actual little green men. And they had a standoff of sorts. There were moments of terror, there was gunfire, elements of this story that seem too bizarre to be real. And it's almost as if it's too bizarre to be real on purpose. I tell you, the skeptics over the years have tried a lot of things to sort of scoff at this story and dismiss it. They said, I have to laugh at this. They said, well, maybe some circus monkeys escaped, and that's what the family saw and shot at. Another debunker came to town. It was like, decades later, he says, these creatures were probably owls. As if a city guy could tell 40 years after the fact, a family that had lived in these woods its entire life, they wouldn't know owls, but he knows owls. Anyway, if you've never read about that case, we posted a version of the tale on the website tonight. My producer Chris and I tried to book a guest who could talk about Kelly Hopkinsville, but we struck out for now. We're to keep trying, though, and maybe have it for a future program. However, we have two other anniversaries of note. One is similar in some ways to the Hopkinsville encounter. It's all about the Thing, the Warminster Thing. And that's the name the locals in the UK gave it. It's not a simple UFO case. It's not even as simple as a UFO flap. This is a very complicated series of events. It kind of all started as weird noises that were reported by multiple witnesses, and then it morphed into a full-scale UFO episode, and it lasted for years. These things were seen by hundreds of people, hundreds of eyewitnesses, and the case was known all over the world. Kind of turned this little place, Warminster, into sort of a UFO mecca for a couple of years. And I guess it still is to a lesser extent, though much of the UFO world has seemingly forgot about the Warminster episode. Not all that surprising in a way. You know, it's right in the same neck of the woods as Stonehenge. And as you might know, that same area has become crop circle central over the last 20 years or so. A couple of books have been written about the Warminster Thing. This year, for the 50th anniversary, two writers who have pursued the mystery from different angles since they were kids, collaborated on a book that lays out the case, warts and all, and there are some, including some hoaxers who complicated things for The Thing. The other anniversary we're marking this month also emanated from the UK, from the town of Liverpool, to be exact. Last year, as you might recall, we hosted a program about the Beatles' conquest of North America, that first tour, 1964, and all the changes that started with that. I had as my guest, just for one segment, Chuck Gunderson, who wrote a massive, beautiful, two-volume book set. It's called Some Fun Tonight. And I promised Chuck then we'd have him back because we barely covered the book at all. 1964, as you know, was when we in America really caught on to the Beatles. 1965, though, is when they kind of cemented the deal, when they returned to the conquered territory, and everything changed. Sociologists have looked at that era as the beginning of so many upheavals that played out through the rest of the 60s into the 70s and are still being felt today. But what was really turned on its head was the music business. The success of that 1965 tour rewrote the rules for pop music, rock music. The Beatles in that year gave birth to stadium concerts, arena rock. Maybe you don't think this is a topic that's your cup of tea, but I can tell you Chuck is a wonderful storyteller. He knows more about those tours than almost anyone, at least anyone who wasn't actually there. And this two-volume book is amazing stuff. So I hope you'll stick around for the second half of the program tonight because it will be, as the title says, Some Fun Tonight. And it tells a lot about how we all changed and grew, and I know you're going to enjoy it. I mentioned the article about Hopkinsville. That's one of the items culled together by webmaster Lex and your host this evening. We post it on the Coast website, and we call it Naps News. Quite a collection of items and oddities in tonight's edition. I've got a link to the video of the Shea Stadium concert. This is the one that changed the playing field, changed everything for rock and pop music and how we see performers. If you've never seen the Beatles at Shea Stadium, it's wonderful footage. This film is beautiful. And, you know, it's since summer and music go hand in hand. I posted that, as well as a list that seems designed to create arguments. It's Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 100 greatest songwriters of all time. Oh, you're going to ground your teeth when you read this thing, some of it anyway. And I suspect that's half the fun. So we got that for your enjoyment and your frustration. Lex also found a short film about the Warminster thing that you might enjoy as a warm-up to our interview. It's starting in just a couple of minutes. Did you see these stories during the week? Two guys in Poland seem to have located a Nazi ghost train loaded with gold. Now, we know, historians know, this train was real. It vanished. They know it was loaded with billions of dollars worth of gold bars. And these guys have hired lawyers in Poland as the first step to see, okay, if we found this thing, can we keep it? Can we keep at least some of it? Also, here's something that won't help you sleep at night. An adorable little video of a robot mom that's building little robot babies. And then in the video, it observes as the cute little cube babies take their first step of sorts. Isn't it kind of cute to see humanity's doom in one little video? I'm kidding, sort of. We got that posted there. Got a fun essay from UFO columnist Billy Cox looking at a recent case that's made some headlines in recent weeks. Plus, the question on everyone's mind, what can we do to help out poor, struggling Wall Street banks? Nothing's too good for the banks. No dollar figure is too much to help out the big banksters, right? When you consider all they do for us, nice to know that we taxpayers are helping to pick up the tab for them so, you know, they can keep the yacht and the place at the beach and the penthouse and the mistresses, naturally. Banks, gotta love them. But you won't after you read this story. While you're on the website, check out the link for how to become a Coast Insider. It's a great deal. For pennies a day, you can listen to the program anytime, as many times as you want, on any device you've got. And you can access a vast archive of previous shows, stuff you may have missed, or programs you want to hear again. You can't beat it. All right, let's get ourselves prepared. What you do is you wriggle out of those cowboy boots or high heels. You slip your feet into some loafers or bunny slippers. You put on an old baggy T-shirt, put on a pot of coffee or a tall, cool beverage. Maybe sit out under the stars in a lounge chair tonight, or better yet, a hammock, and crank up that radio. In a moment, milestone anniversaries. And first up, The Thing, 50 years of the Warminster Thing, with writer Kevin Goodman, live from the UK. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. I got a message from some coast to coast listeners in the high desert of Southern California. They were sitting outside setting up to listen to coast tonight, and a big green UFO flashed right in front of their eyes a couple of minutes ago. I haven't have any more details on whether it was a craft or looked like a bolide meteor or what the heck it was, but they're pretty excited about it. If I get more details, I'll pass them along to you. I don't know if that's a harbinger for things to come because my first guest tonight is a bit of a sky watcher, and in fact, that's why he's here. Kevin Goodman is a veteran of sky watching in the Warminster area of the UK. He continues to be interested in the UFO phenomenon that occurred in Warminster that I described a couple of minutes ago. He has written a previous book about it, UFO Warminster: Cradle of Contact, which is a history of the events that occurred to Kevin and his friends when they started visiting that area in the 1970s, just kids. And eventually they become sort of reluctant contactees. He's co-written a book called History of a Mystery, 50 Years of the Warminster Thing with a guy named Steve Dewey. Welcome to the program for the first time, Kevin Goodman. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there, how are you?
Hey, I really appreciate you being here. I enjoyed reading the book. You know, I had heard about the Warminster flap years ago, as sort of as a footnote in reading about UFOs. Haven't heard about it in a long time, but I remember after reading your book, what a cool case it was. What an interesting case. And you started pursuing it. How old were you? 12, 13, something like that?
I was about, well, no, I started getting into the UFO subject at about the age of 10.
Wow.
And it was only when Arthur Shuttlewood's first book, The Warminster Mystery, was republished in paperback in 1973 that I read it and sort of, you know, was absolutely amazed because up until then I'd always thought the America, you know, America had probably the lion's share of the UFO phenomenon.
Ufology here has sort of forgotten about Warminster, sort of in the same way that, you know, people who are young to are fresh to the topic, they don't remember George Adamski or Giant Rock or some of them, not even Giant Keel. Is Warminster still known in the UK?
Not within the annals of ufology, it's a footnote now, unfortunately.
But you don't have people coming there as UFO tourists anymore?
There is still interest in the phenomenon. People do still visit the town, but not in the vast numbers they did during the 1960s and the early 1970s.
Well, describe the area. Now, I mentioned in the introduction, I don't know if you heard about it, about the Salisbury Plains. Stonehenge is not too far away. There's a lot. We know that area. I visited that area chasing after crop circles. So it's known for a lot of strange stuff and mystical stuff, but this came out of the blue, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it sort of actually broke on Christmas Eve of 1960, Christmas Day, sorry, 1964, when a local housewife was walking up to a church service in early in the morning, and she was assailed by what Arthur Shuttlewood actually sort of wrote was weird crackling noises, menacing sounds, and sudden vibrations, which apparently sort of beat her to her knees, leaving her bemused and befuddled.
There were a couple of people that heard these strange noises or something similar at the same time, right?
Around the same time, yes. I mean, the Warminster area is part, or Salisbury Plain, is part of the British Ministry of Defence's training ground. And there are obviously a lot of military camps in that area. And the soldiers at Nook Camp, a small village called Heytesbury, which is a few miles down the road, actually reported a sound as if a huge chimney stack from the main block had been ripped from the rooftops, then scattered in solid chunks of masonry over the whole area. So yes, there were, you know, it wasn't the only sound sort of heard that night.
So this is right at the end of 64. People start hearing strange sounds, booms, knocking on their homes, things of that sort. The soldiers hear it. But did they immediately jump to a conclusion about it, UFOs or flying saucers? Or did that take a little while?
It took a little while because Warminster is a small was a small market town in Wiltshire, and a lot of the locals really hadn't had a lot of exposure to the UFO phenomenon, which is hence why, until things really started to take off, if you'll pardon the pun, in around the mid-1965 time, they just referred to it as the thing.
And why did who called it that? Is that from the writer?
No, that I think it was a generic name because nobody knew what this phenomenon was, so they just gave it this overall title of the thing.
So weird sounds in the 64, and then they start seeing things in the sky. Tell me about that.
Yeah. It was around May time of 1965 that the first sort of visual sightings of lights in the sky, strange phenomena, actually began.
And what did they see?
Well, one of the reports was that somebody reported seeing what appeared to be two red-hot pokers hanging vertically in the sky over the town, which then sort of, I think, it sort of exploded silently and then just seemed to disappear.
Weren't there some events involving birds that that were kind of weird, bird deaths or something?
Yes, there were a flock of pigeons that were apparently killed in flight while tangling with this object or whatever it was, and apparently stiff-winged. Instant rigor mortis had apparently set in, and they just plummeted to the ground.
So I guess it's percolating in the local area. People are talking about these strange sounds. They're seeing strange things in the sky. But it hadn't gone big until this reporter started writing about it. Tell us about him.
Arthur Shuttlewood.
Yes.
He was the reporter for the local paper, the Warminster Journal. And obviously when this sort of thing sort of started to come into the paper, he was, he picked up on it and reported on it. And it was only later on in 1965 when he saw one of the actual visual manifestations of the thing that he became converted and became a believer, because up until then he claimed to be a hard-headed realist as he was a journalist.
Well, what's your take on that? Because, I mean, some of the things that you explore in this book make him look less as a hard-headed journalist who is objective on this thing and more, at times, almost a cheerleader.
Yeah, he became a cheerleader. I believe he became a guru almost to a generation to a degree. He became converted. He became a believer. And he would often, regularly, go up to one of the hills outside of Warminster, Cradle Hill, and Skywatch, and then obviously people would join him, and it became, I would almost say he became a sort of minor cult.
So give me some details how this unfolded. He wrote about it, about what he had been hearing people in Warminster talking about. He's just a small town newspaper guy, but suddenly he's got a heck of a story on his hands. I would imagine it goes really big, really fast.
It did go really big at one stage. August bank holiday weekend here in England, 1965, due to the amount of sightings and I'd almost use the word hysteria that had been generated by this, the local council decided to call an emergency general meeting sort of for people to attend to allay fears that they weren't going to be invaded or whatever. And the town hall was besieged by concerned residents, interested other parties. They reckon that at least 5,000 people descended on the town that weekend. And because it is a garrison town where there are a lot of soldiers, apparently it's rumored that it was the only time in the town's history that all the pubs ran dry of beer.
Well, that's good business for the town.
Absolutely, it was. You know, people were coming in, flocking in their droves. So, Cradle Hill itself, it is obviously a very rural location. And, you know, people were camping out there. One of the fields, it was almost like a mini Glastonbury.
So Arthur Shuttlewood, he starts writing stories about it. And what's the attitude of his editor? What's the attitude of his paper and the town? How they react to what he's writing?
That's a difficult one to answer. Because, I mean, obviously, I think at the town, because there was nothing else in the town to draw people in, apart from there is a country estate and a country house just outside Warminster called Longleat, which in the 1960s actually sort of started the first safari park in this country. So really, there was nothing to draw people to Warminster. So, of course, it was a good piece of tourism. It was a great piece of sort of PR for them. So at the time, the local people were bemused and befuddled by all of this. So, you know, they were quite happy to have these people come into the town, sort of, you know, try and experience the thing for themselves, and obviously sort of spend money in the town in hotels, restaurants, cafes, and bars.
I would imagine there are a lot of arguments, though, even within families, people who have seen this thing or heard it, trying to explain and convince people who had not, and a lot of skepticism there and a lot of arguments about it. We'll continue our conversation about the Warminster thing right after this break. The Yardbirds take us into the break, and this is a song from 1965. Might have been playing on the radio about the same time that the thing was causing a bit of a ruckus. We'll be back. Classic Motown, that's the Funk Brothers in the background. Martha and the Vandellas, Nowhere to Run, 50 years ago. That was on the airwaves here in the States, and I would imagine in the UK as well. Maybe even heard there in Warminster. We're talking about the Warminster thing with Kevin, who's written about it and studied it and chased after it for most of his life. When we come back, we'll get into some of the theories about what they were seeing in the sky. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Kevin Goodman about his newest work, The History of a Mystery, 50 Years of the Warminster Thing, which is co-written with a guy named Steve Dewey. Kevin, before we go back to talking about the specifics, what happened then and what's happened in between then and now, let's set the stage a little bit about your book and working with this guy, Steve Dewey. You two come at it from much different angles. I mean, he's sort of much more skeptical about the whole thing, and you've actually had hands-on experience, right?
Are a bit like the yin and yang, you know, sort of opposites attract. Steve, I first met Steve actually when I was in Warminster in 1976. We were staying at a dedicated UFO research center that had been set up in a town called Star House, run by a guy called Peter Padgett. And Steve called in the one night to report a UFO sighting that some of his friends had seen. And we all decided to go up onto the hill to that night to have a sky watching. It was very misty and sort of not conducive for sky watching, to be perfectly honest. And I was immediately struck by his sort of forthright, sort of logical attitude towards the phenomenon. And then we lost touch for many, many years until I sort of basically came across him by accident on the internet. And he and I got back in touch, and since then, as they say, it's been history.
But I mean, you do come at it from different viewpoints, so it would seem to be a collaboration of odd fellows.
Well, the odd couple, I suppose.
Yeah, odd couple.
yes, but it's also interesting because the thing is, you can get over immersed into the Warminster phenomenon, particularly if you're a believer, and Steve's attitude, you know, is, you know, let's keep this grounded, let's be subjective, and let's just make sure that we tell the truth as we see it.
You know, as I read your book, it made me want to read earlier books, of course, and I will do that because it's a fascinating study. Not so much of the aliens, it's fascinating for how it plays out among people. I mean, isn't that the most fascinating part, how different people react to it?
Yeah, it's definitely, Warminster is a product of its time. We're talking the mid-1960s. It was almost the start of the hippie movement. It was the age of Aquarius. And a lot of young people in that time were looking for something different. And I think particularly Warminster with the UFO phenomenon and everything else, it struck a chord with people. And that's why it became such a massive phenomenon at the time.
And what chord did it strike with you as a youngster? Just UFOs in general? It was a sense of adventure? What was it?
Well, as I said earlier, I'd been into the subject sort of since I was about 10. Now, I'd been brought up in a good Catholic family, and sort of I started to rebel slightly. I started to question the teachings of the Catholic Church. So much so that sort of I used to have to read these books by torchlight under my duvet or rider down, as they were. And I remember this, and I've got to sort of Americanize this slightly. I remember that sort of one night I was hunkered under the bed reading, I think it was a book called The Flying Saucer Reader by Jay David. And my mother came in and obviously had realized what was going on, so she whipped this eider down off. And I don't think she was, I can't still to this day make up my mind if she's horrified that I was reading a book on UFOs or it wasn't a copy of Penthouse.
Yeah, I can guess. I can guess that I think she was okay with it.
She was in the end, I think, because, I think then they realized that, yes, you know, I was growing up and I was about to start to question things, which was fine. And indeed, it was my father who got me a copy of Erich von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods to read. So, you know, they must have thought something of it in the end.
So you start, I don't know how far Warminster is from where you're living at the time, but it must be fairly close if you started making these pilgrimages.
No, well, I was born and bred in a town called Stourbridge, which is about in the West Midlands near Birmingham. So Warminster was about 120 miles away.
Oh, so
Go
ahead. I'm sorry, just tell me about how it is that you made these trips then.
Well, I used to badger my parents to say, you know, let's go to Wiltshire for a holiday. No, we're going to Wales where the caravan is. So it was 1976, I finally managed, once I'd left school, I'd started college, I'd got a part-time job, I could actually afford to go down to Warminster with a friend for the first time. And 1976, in this country, it was one of the warmest summers on record. And it's the only time since then that you could walk up to Cradle Hill in the evening, sky watch until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and only have to wear a T-shirt and a light pair of trousers.
How many times did you go over the years?
Oh, Lordy, that's a darn good question. I would say regularly for 5-6 years, at least 4 or 5 times a year.
And how long was it, how many trips in, before you saw something? I would imagine that if it didn't happen right away, you know, a youngster can lose interest.
The first night up on the hill.
Oh, my gosh. What'd you see?
I saw something. I don't know if any of your listeners can remember UFO detectors.
I don't know. I don't know how many of the audience does. Tell us about it.
Right. Well, UFO detectors, they're very old-fashioned and sort of, you know, sort of ancient technology now. They were battery-powered devices that had basically a compass needle on the top with a hoop of metal that went over. Now, the theory was at the time that UFOs were somehow tapping themselves into the Earth's magnetic field and there would be a fluctuation as they went over. Now, there were two of these detectors sighted up on Cradle Hill that first night. They were away from any breeze that was there. They were basically sheltered away from each other. They both went off at exactly the same time, so the buzzing sound started. People then started to scan the skies, and we saw two bright star-like objects traveling across parallel to each other. They turned right, carried on, and then just disappeared out of sight. They just basically winked out.
That's the first time. So what else did you have other sightings then?
Yes, not that particular week. It was April of 1977. A friend of mine and I were walking down from the Cradle Hill Copse area, which is at the top of the hill, down towards the main sky watching location, which is an area which was known as the White Gates, because there was a huge, great white metal gate. And this is right on the cusp of the military land as well. So we were walking down, and we glanced over to our right, and over on the right there is a hill which is known as Elm Hill. Now, Elm Hill also has the West Wiltshire Golf Club on it. And coming over from that direction were four red lights, equally distant spaced apart, just pulsing. They carried on coming over another location in the town called Cop Heap, continued over, and then just stopped in this line over an ancient burial mound called Battlesbury Hill. It's an old Iron Age fort, actually, Battlesbury Hill, in this line, just pulsing. Now, it was a moonless night. It was clear. It was just after the sun had gone down, so it was getting pretty dark. There was no wind, and you could hear the trains going through Warminster Railway Station, which was about a mile away as the crow flies. Now, whatever these things were, they were silent, totally silent. So they stayed in this line, just pulsing, and then the left-hand object shot off from a standing start at speed to the left, then performed a flawless 90-degree turn at speed without stopping, and shot straight upwards. And the remaining three lights just basically stayed there for about another 30 seconds to a minute, and then it was as if somebody snapped an elastic band, and they just shot up into the sky as well, and we never saw them again.
In the introduction, you describe yourself and your friends as reluctant contactees. Is that the incident you're referring to? Is there something else going on?
There was something else going on. In October of 1976, so this would have been about, 4 months before we had this fantastic sighting, of which to this day I can't explain what we saw. We were up at Cradle Hill, and on our cassette recorders, we recorded these strange, irregular sets of clicks, which weren't audible to us at the time. So we were puzzled by this, went up the following night with another tape recorder, fresh tape, new batteries, recorded exactly the same thing again. And basically it was a sequence of events that transpired that sort of made us into, as we say, reluctant contactees.
In the 60s, before you were there, and then in the 70s when you were there as a youngster, and people have these kinds of incidents, and you, what do you do with the information? Is there a central clearinghouse? Do you draw pictures of what you saw and take it somewhere? Or was that somewhere to Arthur Shuttlewood, the reporter?
Well, at the time, obviously there was this UFO research center being run by Peter Padgett, which basically was the clearinghouse for any sightings and reports that were made in the area. Shuttlewood was involved himself with the Fountain Center for a few months until he drifted away and sort of became involved with another group that set up in the town. Unfortunately, it's the ugly face of, shall we say, UFO politics, that there were always groups vying for the sort of the top spot. So at the time, in the mid-70s, it would have been Peter Padgett's Fountain Center that would have been the clearinghouse. And he did actually publish his own magazine for, I think, about 12 issues on a semi-regular basis, which obviously then would sort of have reports of any sightings in the local area.
We talked about Shuttlewood a little bit. I don't want to beat a dead horse or anything, but he, you know, he was a small-town reporter who got a whole bunch of attention because of the UFO stuff. I've heard this kind of criticism myself. Well, you know, obviously he made money. He got a lot of attention by doing this. He wrote several books about it. He had an incentive to sort of keep the story going.
Oh, absolutely. I quite agree with you. I mean, one of the reasons why the Warmminster phenomenon lasted so long was that not only was Arthur Shuttlewood continually publicizing it, but people would go to Warmminster, they would see something, go back and tell their friends' interest would be piqued, they'd go to Warmminster and see something, and so therefore it was self-sustaining for getting on towards 15 years until Shuttlewood's ill health stopped him from working.
And then, so interest dies down, the phenomena dies down, but there were a lot of things that happened in between. You had a gigantic, it was like a UFO stampede. It reminds me so much of Roswell to some extent, Area 51. Yeah. You know, so you tell these stories, they go national or international, there's a big stampede. You got a whole bunch of people who flood in and become experts on it, and they all quibble and argue over tiny details. Everybody wants to be top dog. Competing theories, then you get hoaxers, and then it all dies down. I mean, it's been played over so many times, it's amazing the similarities between that, and I'm sure you've noticed the similarities to American cases as well.
Absolutely, and I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And I think one of the death nails for the Warmminster phenomenon, it was in 1977, when South Wales became a UFOcal area around Broadhaven and Tenby. It became known as the Dyfed Enigma. And that lasted for about 18 months. And then, of course, you know, literally at the cusp of the 1980s, you have the Rendlesham incident. So, you know, it was an ongoing thing. And I think Warmminster just basically sort of got shoved out of the way because there were sort of more exciting stories for the press to cover. And that is one of the reasons why I think Warmminster, to a degree, has been forgotten by mainstream ufology.
And then, of course, you got people who want it all to go away for other reasons, the debunkers and the skeptics who are ready to use any excuse to explain something away. As you mentioned, I mean, it's near a military facility. It's very likely that some of those things may have been seen. Were military craft, were conventional or unknown craft, but that doesn't quite explain all of it, does it?
No, it doesn't, no. I would say, well, I mean, Shuttlewood himself said that, you know, in a period of about 2 years, he'd seen something in the region of 5,000 UFOs. Well, a lot of those would have been misidentifications. There's no two ways about that. But, again, at the same time, going back to that sighting I had at Easter 1977, whatever those red lights were, those objects were, it was technology way far beyond anything we've got now, never mind that long ago.
A lot of these witnesses are pretty credible people. They sound like folks who wouldn't make something up just for the attention. I mean, you mentioned about the group of soldiers who had heard the noises. One of the things mentioned in your book is the vicar's wife, the local minister's wife and her son, I guess, saw one and drew pictures of it.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of years ago, I got an email from someone who said that their father was stationed in Warminster, actually on the army base, and he came back from home one night sort of quite puzzled and sort of bemused, because he said he'd been out on what they call stag duty, which is guard duty basically, and to alleviate the boredom at times, you know, he and his colleagues would skywatch, and he saw something that night, something which Arthur Shuttle referred to as an amber gambler. They saw this object actually over the military camp. He had got no idea what it was, and the best of it was there was no air activity, there were no exercises going on at the time. So that is from a member of the armed forces.
One of the things mentioned in your book is that the editor of the local paper got really sick of the UFO stuff. He thought it was an embarrassment to the newspaper, so he kind of shut it down. Is that right?
Yes, basically. I mean, Arthur, I think he decided to sort of semi-retire from journalism. He wrote the first book, The Warminster Mystery, which was picked up by a mainstream publisher and was published in hardback. And then Arthur basically, I think, decided that because he was getting grief from the newspaper, that he would then actually sort of strike out on his own. So his second book was published about 2 years later, which he actually himself self-published. And, I mean, they must have had thousands and thousands of copies printed, because they were still ready for sale and available in the mid-1970s via the various UFO groups in the town.
Characterize for me media coverage of the Warminster thing, how it was treated by London newspapers. We'll talk about BBC in the next segment, because they did a couple of documentaries. But in general, was it the attitude that all these quaint rural rubes are think they're seeing aliens in the sky and kind of chuckling about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, because today of all days in Britain's biggest tabloid newspaper, there is a double page article on Warminster, funnily enough, which I was interviewed for.
Oh.
So around this time of the year, it's what they call the quiet season for news, so they always tend to roll out, shall we say, not the silly season stories, but stories, you know, to sell papers. But there was a photograph taken by a young factory worker by the name of Gordon Faulkner just before the August bank holiday weekend in 1965, which hit the newspapers in a big way. There was a double-page spread in a paper called the Daily Mirror, which purported to show this UFO flying low over the town. Now, debate rages to this day whether that photograph is genuine or not, but the problem with the photograph is there is no form of reference to it at all. It's the classic iconic picture of Warminster. You know, if anybody was to type in Warminster UFO in Google, probably one of the first three photographs that would come up would be of this UFO. But it's been blown up so much that the individual grains of emulsion on the negative are clearly visible. So, you know, the actual thing itself, as it was flying over the town, must have been literally like a little speck in the distance. And the guy claims that he just saw it come into the viewfinder, pressed the shutter, and hey presto, suddenly there it is, the iconic photograph.
I'm looking at that photograph, and yeah, it's pretty grainy, but there's quite a controversial story about how it was obtained and then the claims that were made about it. We're going to get into that in a moment here, talking about the Warminster thing with Kevin Goodman, author of History of a Mystery, 50 Years of the Warminster Thing. The Birds from 1965 take us into the break with one of their big hits written by Bob Dylan.